May we pray together. Our Heavenly Father, now in the silence of our hearts, examine our lives and through Thy Spirit, illuminate for us what Thy will is as we work for Thee from day to day. Thou dost know our needs, and now in the silence of our hearts, we offer up unto Thee the confession of sin and the needs that we have, and we pray that Thou wilt lead us as we listen. For it is in Christ's name that we ask it. Amen. We were grateful for Professor Tull giving you the biographical highlights of Dr. Novak's academic career, and I see no use in repeating those this morning, though I know there are several of you who perhaps were not here yesterday. Without Dr. Novak's asking or even hinting me to do so, I wanted to take just a minute to be a book salesman. I know I wouldn't make a living selling books, but I do want to mention to you three of his many books that have proved especially helpful to me. They're all three available in paperback and are in the bookstores. I think one of them is on order right now that has been sold out, but he's written many books, but these three have been especially helpful to me. One is The Ascent of the Mountain and The Flight of the Dove, which is subtitled An Invitation to Religious Studies and is analysis of the religious experience that we encounter in our lives. And I would certainly strongly recommend that you read this book sometime soon when you get the opportunity. The other one is also paperback, entitled The Experience of Nothingness, which is an analysis of the loss of meaning and of meaningfulness in our contemporary technological lives. And it has been especially helpful to me, too. And then the book that bears the title of Dr. Novak's lectures for these 2 days, A Theology for Radical Politics, is also available in paperback, and I would strongly urge that you read it, too, if you have not had the opportunity to do so. By way of introduction, I want to read just one paragraph from A Theology for Radical Politics, and then we will turn our discussion over for the second day to Dr. Novak. On page 36 and 37 in The Theology of Radical Politics, he writes, "But what does it mean to seek your own identity? By what test do you know that you have found yourself? What is it that you look for? This question is different from all others. There is no litmus test to tell you which is your real self. The reason why the question, 'Who am I?' is unlike the question, 'What is oxygen?' is that there is no possible way of getting outside oneself so as to turn oneself into a problem, into a subject matter for objective analysis. The crucial difference is that at a certain point, you decide who you are, you create yourself. No one is God, no one creates himself out of nothing, and no one can decide to become just anything at all. But once one has come to some sort of assessment of the range of one's own temperament, personality, and talents, and has come to some awareness of alternative ways of life, then one can choose to realize one among several possible identities. A man is not himself, he becomes himself. He steps out ahead and fashions an identity for himself." A fine insight and typical of many in this book and the other two and others of Dr. Novak's book that have benefited all of us. Dr. Novak, we welcome you for the second lecture.
I was talking yesterday about the experience of nothingness, and I would like to begin where I left off so as to connect the 2 days as well as I can. I stressed that the experience of nothingness is an experience. One might call it by any other name. That doesn't matter very much. And I suggested that as an experience, it's better known by descriptions, better known by giving examples of the occurrence of this experience in many different people. If you give a definition of an experience prematurely, bright people, knowing grammar, knowing the meaning of words, grasp the definition and think they understand. It's easy to cover all the ground without ever touching it. And so I, in a case like this, would normally resist giving a definition. It's much more important that people become aware of the experience within themselves or in the lives of others and know how to recognize it than that they be able to give a good definition of it. But because time is a little bit short, I'm going to take a more direct and in a way more dangerous route and not give the kind of examples that I really ought to give, and say outright that the experience of nothingness is at its heart and essentially an experience of formlessness. One comes to the perception that there is no one form of life that one has to live out. That in front of one, as it were, are multiple forms, dozens of forms, dozens of different ways of living, which one could choose as one's own. And nothing forces one to adopt one of those forms rather than another. In one respect, the experience of nothingness is an experience of freedom, of non-coercion, of non-necessity. But it is exceedingly personal. It is exceedingly one's own. And so when the experience arises, it commonly presents a problem of action. Without forms, without a sense of where we're going and what the world is like in which we're acting, we can't act. The moment we begin to act, we're living in this way rather than in that way. We're going in this direction rather than in that direction. Whether we're thinking about it or not, we're creating a form. A novelist who might be watching us would see quickly what story it is we're living out, whether we see it or not. When the experience of nothingness arises, it undercuts the forms of life that one has been living out and undercuts those that are set up as alternatives, that are there as alternatives. And it makes it difficult for us to choose which way to live, or why it makes any difference to live one way rather than another. And in this respect, ordinarily, it makes it very hard for a person to go on acting. There's no point in one direction rather than another. No reason to exert oneself. And in fact, it even seems like a lie to exert oneself. Almost anything that one does seems to indicate that one cares. And if caring is undercut, then the action is undercut. Now, it's true that the experience of nothingness, which is surprisingly common on every level in our society, it's not limited to the young, it's not limited to the students, it's not limited to the takers of drugs or the participants in radical politics. It's just as common among teachers of Sunday school, among men and women who work in textile factories, among bankers and realtors and businessmen of all sorts. It's very common throughout our society. People who at a certain point in their lives see that perhaps their lives had no point. They were doing routinely and automatically and perhaps even happily what was handed to them. It was as though somebody put them on roller skates, gave them a push, and they were still going through life on that push. And suddenly the push wears out, and they wonder why they've been doing what they've been doing. Now, when the experience arises, it doesn't bring with it its own solution. The question, if I may formulate it, is rather like this. Granted that I have the experience of nothingness, I mean, there it is. What should I do with it? The outcome may be a destructive one. It is true, as one of you mentioned yesterday, that a not modest number of people who have gone through the experience in the last few years, especially among the young, are dead or in prison or simply missing. Extraordinary number of people just disappeared. It does end sometimes in suicide or in self-destruction. Or in dissipation of one sort or another. So I wouldn't like to suggest that the experience of nothingness always brings with it a happy ending. What I am trying to suggest, though, is that the experience is of itself a very fruitful one, worth pursuing, worth prolonging rather than escaping. The longer and the deeper one can go into it, as it were, the sounder and the more steady the foundations of the rest of one's life. I mean, if you've been down to a certain depth, later on in life, you don't have to worry when you're going down to that depth. You know all that already. After you get past that, you may panic a little bit. But the point is, the worse it can get, and you know you can cope with that, the easier it is later, when much less tragic and difficult things arise. Still, in the brevity of time, I want to turn to a suggestion. There's a Buddhist saying The void is not empty, but full. And it's not, it's more sensible and more direct than it is paradoxical, that saying. If you look at those who have written about the experience of nothingness, calling it by various names, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard, Freud, Camus, Sartre, and many others. You'll notice, first of all, that they write books, which is not insignificant. Writing books is not the most pleasant and easy activity that one would choose. There are millions of other things one could be doing rather than being at one's desk, pushing a pen or pencil over lines of paper. That's not exactly the most attractive way to imagine living one's life. And in that very fact of writing books, there is some clue. That reach for communication. In any case, you'll notice that in those who write about and describe the experience of nothingness, there is clear evidence of the preconditions required for the experience of nothingness to arise. The experience of nothingness is always close to human beings. Fingers beat upon the window pane, as T.S. Eliot put it. But you don't have to pay attention. Pascal wrote that life is an everlasting divertissement, an everlasting diversion. The whole point of life is to divert one's attention from this experience, keep one's eyes away from it. You have what Norman Mailer calls the everlasting nihilism of the muzak at O'Hare Terminal in Chicago. The music playing always in the background in the department stores, in people's automobiles as they drive. Well, what is necessary for the experience to arrive in consciousness, since it is so easy to avoid? A certain kind of honesty first. Without the willingness to look, one simply won't notice the experience. At any given moment, there are dozens of things we can be aware of in consciousness. If an airplane were passing overhead or a car screeching outside, you could be thinking about those. Or what you're going to do later today, or what has already happened today, or what you've eaten, or the pressure of the seats upon your bottoms. 100 things can be on your consciousness as well as the words I'm speaking. In whichever of those things you attend to, those you make real. And if you don't attend to my words, they just don't exist as far as you're concerned. And depending on the degree of attention, to that degree they exist. And they exist very differently for each one of you. We always give each other quite different degrees of attention. And with some people it's easy to be completely present because they give you complete receptivity. And others are always listening only partially. The point is that our attention, the degree of consciousness that we muster for any given occasion or any given event or any given stimulus is very different, and it's our own. Well, there is required for the experience of nothingness to arise a certain degree of honesty in one's attention. One has to be willing to notice it. and not to run away from it. And that honesty isn't possible without a kind of courage. There's a difference between seeing something and seeing it in such a way as to make a difference. Your wife tells you you're conceited. You've always known she doesn't understand you. So it doesn't make you know what it means to be conceited. You examine your conduct, you know you're not conceited. What does she know? Besides, she's always criticizing. You see exactly what she means, but you don't assent to it. And a year later, a little less threatened for some reason, remembering the behavior she was speaking about, you see exactly what she meant, and she was right. You were conceited. So you could see it on one occasion and yet not see it. And on a later occasion, see it again, but now in a very different light. And you can see some things without doing anything about them, and then see them in such a powerful way all of a sudden, something you've known all your life. You suddenly look at it in a different way, and now it makes you act very differently. Sometimes we call that consciousness raising, something we were always aware of, but now are aware of in a different way, so that it breeds action. Well, there are different ways of seeing, and courage has a lot to do with that. We allow ourselves to see, often, only those things we have the courage to act on. If it demands more courage than we have, we don't quite allow ourselves to see it. And thirdly, since our attention is our own, honesty and courage aren't the only things required. A certain exercise of freedom is required. Choosing to allow this experience either to arise, or if it arises without our will, as it sometimes does, forcing itself upon us, to keep our attention on it, not to run away from it. There's a tremendous, overwhelming temptation in the United States to keep busy, do anything to disallow this experience. Even when you end the lecture, people often say, "Well, Mr. Novak, that's a very good description, but what are we going to do about it?" Whatever the problem is. In America, there's a kind of inner demand that reality is only when you do something. So when we end a public discussion or a meeting or a lecture of any sort, you have to create a kind of ritual that allows this demand, the sense of reality, to be expressed. Americans only feel right with the world when they think they can do something, even if they know what they're doing isn't going to do anything. It's a ritual one has to go through of doing something. So at the end of a meeting, it's always a good idea to end up with a practical resolve for doing something effective, like starting a committee. And everybody feels better right away. Even though they know nothing will happen between this meeting and the next, one has been in tune with reality if one does something. Well, correspondingly with the experience of nothingness, one might imagine that the whole American enterprise is a desire to live apart from the experience of nothingness, to keep moving towards new frontiers, to keep busy, to keep active, to keep doing. In an almost frantic desire to act, to avoid being still. Well, anyway, without honesty, without courage, without an exercise of freedom, the experience of nothingness doesn't arise. And finally, without a certain reality of community, it doesn't arise. Although it feels as though the experience of nothingness is completely individual and solitary, it is actually shared by everybody, or can be. stronger than that. Because the experience of nothingness cuts beneath all forms of life, cuts beneath all cultures, cuts beneath all symbols. The experience of nothingness is the experience of the human race that most unites people across cultures, transculturally, interculturally. Black, white, yellow, brown, every continent, every age of history, in every part of the population, the experience of nothingness arises. It shows to every human being that whatever the way they are living, whatever the culture in which they're living, whatever the economic system, whatever the political order, whatever the religious symbols, whatever the way of life, masculine or feminine, the way they have been imagining themselves, the way they have been perceiving, the way they have been acting, is not necessary. That is one expression of human liberty, one expression of human culture, one expression of human life. It is not divine. It is not uncriticizable. It is not fixed for all eternity. Other ways of living are possible. Now, these qualities, honesty and courage and freedom and community, are required for the experience of nothing. They're its preconditions. It won't arise without them. One can, therefore, in being faithful to the experience of nothingness, take the experience of nothingness as a kind of criterion for a certain honesty in living. The experience of nothingness has a good feel to it. It feels right. And supposing one wants to do nothing that interferes with the experience of nothingness, then these activities could be strengthened in one's life: honesty, courage, freedom, community, without blocking the experience of nothingness. If you try to multiply the frequency of acts of honesty in your life, of acts of courage, of acts of freedom, a recognition of the community in which you participate, mostly unawares, you don't destroy the experience of nothingness, you deepen it. Thus, one could propose that one build one's life around these activities. That life is more real, one might propose, in which there are more frequent acts of honesty, courage, freedom, and community. And that life is less real, less substantive, more missing the point, more doing nothing at all, spinning its wheels, in which these activities are less frequent. The more frequent, the more being. The less frequent, the less being. Nothing obliges one to take this interpretation. Ethics comes to us in this view not so much as an obligation, a duty, or an ought, but as an invitation. It is possible to live this way, and it is attractive to live this way. It is more a Greek sense of ethics in the sense that the words for obligation are very weak. And the power of an ethical system derives from its attractiveness. It attracts us as beauty attracts us. One wants to imitate it. That's the heart of ethics, the drive for imitation, for beauty. The word for good is the same as the word for beautiful. Beautiful man, we say. Well, anyway, what I would take as one criterion of radical, whether personal or political, is the frequency of such of these acts, of these four activities: honesty, courage, freedom, community. They provide a very effective base for personal ethic and for a social ethic. They don't do all the work required, but they give a very good start. Thus, a theology for radical politics is a theology which arrives early at these activities. Pascal said there are not three honest men in a century. He didn't mean there were two. He meant that it's exceedingly difficult to be honest. The just man sins seven times a day. Meaning, one can't be honest even over a 24-hour period. Nothing is easier than to flatter a human being. Tell a man he has a beautiful hook shot, and he'll believe it. That he has a handsome nose, and forever after, looking in a mirror, he'll think his nose is good looking. Wonder why you said so, but believe it. Even professors, our profession is truth, but nothing is easier than to flatter us. We commonly imagine our own role in the intellectual life of our time is far more significant than in fact it is. And it's not unknown for us in picking up a book in our field to look first of all at the index to see if our name is cited, which shows you something about where our center, the meaning of reality, may be. There's nothing easier than to move human beings away from the truth. I only stress that by way of saying that one should not assume that activities of honesty and courage and freedom and community are frequent in our behavior. In some sense, they are. It's rather amazing how much of all of them there is, considering. But in another sense, it's sometimes hard to think over your life and imagine when was the last time you did something freely. At least in a strong sense of free. Such an incredible amount of our life is drift, waiting to see what will happen, playing it by ear, responding to circumstance. Sometimes I think that Americans have become, far from being those who are get up and go and get up and do, that Americans have become the pussycats of the world, living in such a rapidly flowing and such a strict system that the only way to survive is to drift. You ask young people what they want to do or what they want to become, what they want to major in, what they're going to do their thesis in, where they're going to look for a job. Everybody's putting it off as long as possible, playing it by ear, waiting to see what develops. Well, anyway, I'm just trying to suggest that increasing the frequency of honesty, of courage, of freedom, of community, the recognition of community, the recognition of how much we actually live in community, we simply don't even notice that. That increasing those things takes a certain amount of effort. They don't happen automatically. And that in that sense too, that attending to those and putting that effort is in a way to create something in your life which isn't there. It's another way in which, if you want to look at it this way, this is an ethic of being, of putting things there that weren't there, of creating. And I think, again, it's in this sense that the Buddhist saying is fulfilled. The void is not empty, but full. That in the very attempt to deepen the experience of nothingness, one creates. And in the very act of creating, one deepens the sense of the nothingness, the mirage, the illusion in which we're living. The dreamlike world in which we're living. But I want to move on as quickly as I can to the more political side. I've spent a little bit more time on the mystique side, the mystical side, if you wish, than I would normally, partly because it's a seminary and theological school. But I do want to move on to the political side. One criterion for the use of the word radical, I would say, has to do with its recognition of the experience of nothingness and of those four activities I mentioned. The second criterion for radical politics would be that it always places before itself the question, what does any given program or movement mean for working class people? Black and white and brown, whatever color, but for working class people, people who work for a living. In our terms in the United States, people whose incomes are between what, $7,000 and $14,000 a year, or say $16,000 a year to include the 90%. Let me pause for a moment to repeat that even if you're making $16,000 a year and you have three or four children, that's a good amount of money. But if you have three or four children, it's too much money to qualify you for scholarships, but not enough to send them all to school. So it is not what you think of as affluence. It's certainly not what you think of as power. Though by the standards of the world's living, it's terribly high. In any case, the second criterion, the political criterion for what is radical, is to think of every given program, what does it do for working people? What does it do for people who work in the post office, who drive buses, people who work in factories? The average income in factory, among factory people in 1973, was $8,600. That's no way to get rich. And by the way, it doesn't go up and up as you get older. It peaks about age 35. For 90% of working people in the United States, there are no open-ended jobs. They reach their highest income about the age of 35 and level off. And there's no more reward or promotion. If you're teaching, if you're in professional life, you imagine that in each decade of your life, you'll be making more money than you were before. That doesn't happen for the majority of Americans. The future is open-ended for them till about the age of 35, and that fixes for them. Now, we don't think naturally about working people in the United States because those who define the meaning of political problems are increasingly, since the Second World War, it didn't used to happen this way, but since the Second World War, those who define the meaning of political problems are increasingly from the chosen from the top 10% of the population in the universities and in the media. Before the Second World War, we didn't have television. Television is only 25 years old. And we really didn't have national news magazines. I mean, Time had been founded, but the national news magazines really came into their own after the Second World War. And the influence of the New York Times and the Washington Post and other major papers has been spread by television and by the national magazines. It used to be if you were in the locality, you read about them. But if you weren't, you never knew what they said. And now if they break his story, it's picked up by someone else. The point is, we're living in a national culture. And those who shape the national culture, those who tell us what's happening, are all college graduates. And usually more than just college graduates. And they're all in the top 10% of the nation by income. And they live in a national style. They work here for a while, and there for a while, and there for a while, as I did. I work in Massachusetts, I work in California, I've taught in the Midwest. People who live in a national culture. We're not local people. Now, when this class, this mobile, national, affluent, highly educated class controls the universities, which are also national, and the media, which are national, naturally enough, they talk about their own problems. In interpreting America, they interpret it from their point of view. You get the impression, for example, that divorce is running rampant in the United States. Well, it is in that class. But 66% of all Americans stay together, man and wife, for a lifetime. I think that's an astonishing percentage. Marriage is very difficult, not least under modern conditions. And nevertheless, 66% of Americans stay together for a lifetime, man and wife. Now, that's one way to look at the figures. The other way to look at the figures is to say that about half of the people get divorced. But the reason that figure gets inflated is the people who get divorced tend to get divorced 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. In other words, if you count up the number of divorces, it's much greater than the range of the people getting divorced. That same 1/3 of the population gets divorced so many times that about half the interchanges in the United States are divorces and about half are marriages. But it's among the same people. And in so many other issues. American politics comes to be defined according to the problems and preoccupations of the upper 10% of the population. This is always true in the Republican Party, I think it's fair to say, without being partisan. It was always the party of big business, as it liked to call itself. But it's also become true in the Democratic Party. The way problems are defined in the Democratic Party is increasingly from the point of view of the university class, the media class. And working people, and the effects of national politics on working people, are almost never considered. And there isn't any major political figure who speaks to the problems of working people, except George Wallace. And a major reason for George Wallace's success is that he's all alone. Nobody else is even close to the ballpark in the kind of issues he raises year after year. He's virtually unchallenged. Now, that's the political situation which I think it's urgent upon us to correct. There shouldn't only be George Wallace attacking working people problems. Everybody on the left, everybody who believes in progress, everybody who believes in a radical criticism of the culture in which they live, should be attacking those problems. The second criterion for radical, I repeat, is always to ask, what does this mean for working people? Now, there are two main areas in the United States where I think this problem is especially acute. One is in the South, and one is in the northern cities. The one I know best, naturally enough, is in the northern cities. The one I know where a lot of work needs to be done, but I don't know how to go about doing it, is in the South. And that's what I present to you. An extraordinary amount of American history, economic analysis, cultural analysis, literature, everything is done from Boston southwards and westwards. The country is way off balance in its self-understanding. One of the requirements of being a major historian in the United States is to live and work in Boston. They call Boston the hub of the universe, and I say that's because the rest of the world is moving. I asked a woman in the Boston area once, where was she born? And she said out west in Worcester, which is about 60 miles from Boston. That's not an unfair characterization of the Bostonians' view of the world, the Bostonians' view of American history. We talk about the Protestant ethic in America, talk about the power of the Puritan ethic in America. You could count the number of Puritans in America on two hands. You could count the number of counties in the United States today in which Puritans are more than half of the population on less than two hands. This is not a country built around the Puritan ethic. Even insofar as the nation is Protestant, and it is a very Protestant country. Those who are Catholic and Jew and other can only see that. It's a very Protestant country. It's a very difficult country for us to work in symbolically, because the symbols are not ours. But even insofar as the country is Protestant, it is infinitely more an evangelical country than it is a Puritan country. Insofar as the nation has a civil religion influenced by its religious past, that is, insofar as the United States itself conducts its business and talks about itself as if it were a religion rather than a nation, and it does. We talk a lot about losing faith in America, the constituency of conscience, a politics of compassion, and so forth. All religious words. The way Americans talk about the country, you'd swear it was a religion, you'd swear it was a church, not just a plain old country like every other country. And that's true among conservatives as among people on the left. The passion for talking about the country is a religious passion, not just a political argument. Insofar as that civil religion derives from the religious traditions of the nation, I still would argue that it derives more from the evangelical traditions, more from the Baptists and the Methodists than from the Unitarians, or even the Congregationalists, or the Episcopalian churches of New England. As I'm not Protestant, but I try to understand America and come to terms with the reality of America, what I've had to unlearn from the textbooks, we'll put it this way, what I learned from the textbooks is to look for the signs of Puritanism and signs of New England everywhere. What I've had to learn from life is the reverse. Those are largely insignificant. I'm exaggerating. But those are not nearly so significant as coming to terms with the huge expanse of the evangelical churches, which are much more effective upon our music, upon the way people talk, the way people think, the way people feel. Yet the books and the divinity schools and the rest are much more concentrated on their much more narrow base. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, if you want to find books that describe the Protestant history of America, and do it from the point of view of the Baptist and the Methodist churches, the churches of the South and the West, but really the churches of everywhere, the churches of Manhattan, the churches of Pittsburgh, because also in those cities, the high churches are a small minority. If you want to do a history of Protestantism in the United States, it should start over with the evangelical churches and maybe give a chapter to the high churches. If you're going to do a history of bankers in the United States, do the high churches, yes. members of boards of trustees and heads of corporations, do the high churches. But if you're going to do a religious history of the United States, you've got to do the evangelical churches, and that isn't being done. We've got to have, before we have an effective politics, we've got to have even some effective intellectual work about our own people. Who are our people? Who are George Wallace's parents? What was their life like? What does it mean to grow up in the way that Wallace grew up? And where would I find that in novels or plays or sociology or history? If I want to understand Lyndon Johnson's background, Lawton Chile's background, Jimmy Carter's background, and so forth, where would I go in American history? I couldn't find it now, hardly. And yet how are you going to understand America unless everybody in America knows that thoroughly? How are politicians going to think about it unless that kind of knowledge permeates the newspapers and the television? How often have you seen Southern working people on television and recognized them as people you knew or in the magazines or whatever? Most of America is invisible to America. And in particular, Southern working people, black and white, not at the point of militance, not at the point of opposition, that we see, that we can understand. But in the ordinary context of their lives, that we don't see very well. It's no wonder we don't think politically about how to bring that out. And the same thing is true of the 50 to 70 million people who came to this country from Southern or Eastern Europe, my own grandparents and all those others, in the last 100 years. As long ago as blacks in this country were slaves, our ancestors were serfs, not allowed to own their own land, not allowed to work for themselves. The European version of slavery, all through the Slavic countries and all through Southern Europe. And we have been free men and free women only as long as blacks have been free men and free women in this country. And don't feel any guilt about slavery. Have a very different reaction with blacks than is true here in the South. Don't have the history with them. Met them in the northern cities at a time in which we both came at about the same time, although the greatest migration of blacks has come in the last 20 years and before that, 20 years before that, two great migrations of blacks in 1920 and the 1940s. And another migration about the turn of the century. Both coming upon an industrial society for the first time as competitors. So a very different complex of emotions, white and black, in our part of the country. I don't mean better, I don't mean worse, I mean different. And here. Well, all these things have to be better understood. The cultural history out of which working class people in the South come, the cultural history out of which working class people in the North come, white and black. And unless we understand those things better, it's most improbable that we would create an effective politics. So long as politics is designed by those at the top, it will always divide those at the bottom so that they fight among one another. Only when politics is designed from the bottom up in a way to improve the lot of those mutually on the bottom. One may be ahead or behind, but they're at the bottom. Only when politics is defined from the point of view of what makes life better for them is there some hope of their moving forward. And only if the bottom moves forward is it a radical politics. Otherwise, it's the same old order. Now, almost anywhere you look, whether in terms of the understanding, the cultural articulation, or in terms of the political programs, nobody is doing that work. What's called radical politics in the United States is in fact just the device of the most affluent, most highly educated. It's called radical chic because it isn't really radical. It's just a new way of maintaining their own power. And it quite consistently divides people on the bottom against one another. Now, I mean very simple things. I mean that commonly a policeman in Georgia or North Carolina has a very different attitude towards the law, the meaning of the law, the meaning of good and the meaning of evil, because it comes out of a Protestant background, and a specific Protestant background, from a policeman in Chicago or Detroit or New York, because he comes out of a Southern or Eastern European background, probably. Let me give you one or two examples of that in conclusion. I'm going to speak very generally and very roughly. By and large, in the northwestern part of Europe, when we say Anglo-Saxon, we mean English, England, and Germany. Where's Saxony? Saxony's in Germany. The English and the Germans are brothers from way, way back, as the word Anglo-Saxon suggests. And the French, too. There was a Norman invasion of England. Sometimes people say to me, but I'm not anything at all. I'm a whole melting pot. And I say, what were your grandparents? And they say, they're all mixed. They have everything in. I say, no, really, what were your grandparents? They say, well, one was English, one was Welsh, one was German, one was French. They're everything. It's all mixed up. And I say, that sounds all one to me. It's all one family of the world. It's the same culture. That's why when we go to college, we read French philosophy and German philosophy, and in theology, French and German theology, and nothing else. It's all our family. But in any case, in the northwestern part of the world, roughly speaking, when you say religion, the implicit image way off in the background is that of a sky god. And the language about religion is associated with the language about morality. So that if you're not really moral, you're not really religious. To be religious is to be moral. It's to do good. It's to love one's brothers and sisters. And if you don't really do that, you're not religious. You're a hypocrite or a liar. In Southern and Eastern Europe, way in the background, God is imagined much more like an earth god. And religion is associated much more with nature than with morality. So that it's quite conceivable that a person could be utterly immoral and yet marvelously religious. Morality, immorality has very little to do with religion. Religion's of a different order altogether. I'm going to exaggerate, but it's almost as if you said, God is too great to be worried about morality. Morality, immorality, what difference does that make to God? What are you going to do that's so moral that it's going to impress God? Or so immoral that it's going to distress him? Of course, better to be moral than not moral. But human beings being what they are, a certain amount of immorality is to be expected. And that has nothing to do with being religious. Sometimes moral people are the most irreligious people you'll ever meet. All I'm trying to do is say there's two different thought worlds here. Now, it shows up in politics because, generally speaking, if you're dealing with Anglo-Saxons, a little bit more in different groups than with others, generally speaking, if you call Anglo-Saxons to account, try to make them feel guilty, they love it. They'll even cheer and yell and buy tickets to come and hear more of it. Guilt is the main language of the Anglo-Saxon. I mean, as one who is not an Anglo-Saxon sees that in America. If you make people feel guilty, they seem to love it. And if you approach subjects from the point of view of guilt, you're wrong for this. If you point the finger of accusation, that's the main literary form of television, a documentary on television. Always starts out showing you a big problem, trying to make you feel bad about it, so that you'll do something about it at the end. Every time Americans talk to one another, that's the way that even Playboy magazine is telling you all the time you really should be a Playboy. And if you're not, you're hung up. You should feel bad about it and be converted. I mean, Americans are always trying to convert one another. Well, that's this Protestant background, I think, that one who is not out of that feels very strongly. Whereas you cannot go into an Italian section of Brooklyn, or the Irish section of South Boston, or wherever, Slavic section of Cicero, Illinois. You can't go in there and point a finger of guilt at people and expect them to cheer, or even to feel guilt. They don't feel guilty. And they're tough and they'll fight. They feel in competition, and they feel blocked at every turn. And they'll fight. I'm not saying it's pleasant. But you won't make them feel guilty. They don't feel guilty about slavery. Don't feel guilty about the situation of blacks in the United States. Don't feel guilty about a whole set of things. And you cannot approach them in a moralistic tone of voice and get anywhere. Generally speaking, when a Catholic hears somebody say moral or immoral in politics, he thinks, I don't know how yet, but they're out to get me. One of the features of being a Catholic in the United States is no matter what we do, we will never be sufficiently moral. Whatever we do, even if it's play bingo, we're immoral. You just got to get used to it. Let's start out from the fact we're not as moral as other people. So what's new? What I'm trying to say is these cultural materials we have hardly attended to. We hardly even know our own. And we hardly know how to relate ourselves to groups not our own. And until some of our intellectual people and our teachers and our ministers, librarians and everybody begin to work some of this through, there's going to be constant misunderstanding. We cannot have a successful radical politics unless a lot of the preliminary cultural work is well done. And in speaking for the South and in the South and speaking for working people, if you don't do it, you know, who's going to do it? If you don't take up the task, do you think Harvard and Yale are going to do it? Where will it be done if not by you?